The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Okay, well, we're going to get going. I mean, unfortunately, there's probably going to be a few people trying to play the commando and climb over everybody as we get going, but otherwise we're never going to get out of here. Okay. Right, so we're going to start to look a little bit more about what's occurring that will actually impact upon us directly and, you know, maybe some of the things that we need to be thinking about. And as I said, you know, please don't take anything I say at face value. Please, you know, do your own research. And, you know, I'm certainly not trying to create fear or panic in any way, shape or form. I do understand the people who are hearing this for the first time, they are inevitably going to go through the process of fear and anger, and hopefully will come out the other side. And, you know, then obviously, you know, do whatever it is that they feel they need to do to go forward. But that is not the intention of the evening. The intention of the evening here is to try and give people the opportunity to get some insight into what's occurring and then actually encourage you to take a look for yourselves and, you know, try and avoid getting caught up in what's occurring, because as you'll see, unfortunately, a hell of a lot of people have no clue, because the only thing they're interested in is X Factor or Strictly Come Dancing or Corrie or EastEnders, and of course this is deliberate. You know, I was giving a talk in London a few months ago, and I was running a bit behind schedule, and I jumped a cab to get to my destination. It was a Saturday afternoon, and the cab driver said to me, he started talking about football, and, you know, I wasn't very responsive, and he said, so you don't, forgive the accent, he said, so you don't watch football then, mate? I said, no, I really haven't got, you know, much of a clue. He said, oh, if it wasn't for me footy, I don't know what I'd do. And I thought, you know, and I said, well, you know, I just think, oh, my God, you know, how sad. This guy lived for his football. His raison d'etre was to be able to go to the next Chelsea game. So, when, hey, you know, it takes all sorts, and I'm not knocking football. I mean, it's a wonderful distraction. But, you know, some, for some people, of course, it's the reason for living. And these people have no clue. They have no idea what's coming down the pipe, you know, and they're going to have no preparation for it whatsoever. And that's when things start to get really messy. David Rockefeller, 17 years ago, said in a presentation to the UN Economic Council, he said, we are on the verge of global transformation. All we need is the right major crisis, and the nations will accept the new world order. And of course, this is the phrase that trotted off of Gordon Brown's tongue with alarming regularity. In fact, in Fool Me Once, in the DVD I recorded in 2007, I actually take a clip from a speech that Gordon Brown gave at the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry, just a few weeks before he had the office of Prime Minister conferred on him. Obviously another unelected Prime Minister. And in that speech, he uses the phrases New World Order, New Financial Order, so many times. I mean, it's embarrassing. It's very clear he'd been told that, you know, boy, you need to show that you're signed up to this script if you want to have that office of Prime Minister. And he was a broken man when he was Prime Minister. The New World Order, the One World Government, and of course, Freedom Tower. Freedom Tower, this massive construction project that's going to replace the World Trade Center. Freedom Tower has now been renamed One World Trade Center. And of course, they're saying, well, previously it was World Trade Center 1, now it's just One World Trade Center. But no, it's not. It's One World Trade Center. Just like Denver Airport, when that was opened in 1996, I think it was, 1996, it's the Denver One World Airport. And go Google Denver Airport murals, and you will see the most incredibly graphic artwork which spells out the pernicious agenda of those who think they're the rightful rulers of the planet. So how is this crisis going to manifest? You know, they're going to try and make it so major that people beg them to establish this global government. And of course, Henry Kissinger said, you know, a number of years ago, now 20 years ago, he said, you know, if we put the troops on the streets of Los Angeles today, the people would be in absolute uproar. But in 20 years' time, the people will be begging us to put the troops on the streets of Los Angeles. And of course, thanks to the latest death of Osama, I got that right, yes. Thanks. I had to think about that one. Thanks to the latest Death of Osama, now we're starting to see all the ramp up hype and fear about a retaliation attack. All of these nukes that Osama supposedly had access to. And, you know, so they're building up for another false flag attack, potentially, in Europe. But what's being bandied in the US now is the TSA, this organization that has implemented these body scanners in US airports, and we're having the pat-downs. And now they're talking about needing to have scanners and pat-downs and security measures on the trains. So every time, you know, imagine, I mean, how many years is it before you go to work and you've got to go through a body scanner or you've got to subject yourself to a pat-down? And I tell you what, I was flying to Dublin from Exeter Airport a few weeks ago, and something, I mean, I had no shoes on, you know, no belt on. You know, what do we have? We've had the shoe bomber, you know, so we have to take off our shoes. We've had the underpants bomber, so we have to take off the belt and get the pat down. I just hope none of these guys decide to stick a dynamite up their arms. Anyway, at Exeter Airport, this guy was patting me down. And as he patted me down, I mean, he literally ran his hand across my crotch. And I said, you know, if you do that again, you're going to have an involuntary action and my knee's going to come into your jaw. And he went white. He went absolutely white. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that again. And I'm not going to say that again. And I said, and if there is any repeat of this, then I shall make a big issue out of it. But this is starting to get ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's far worse in the US, by the way, than it is here. But anyway, so how's this going to affect us in terms of the economy? Well, oh gosh, please don't die on me again. How's this going to affect us? Of course, you know, people think that, you know, we're at the bottom of the housing market. I'm sorry, but property has a long, long, long way to fall. And even in today's paper is the statement of fact that property has fallen by 40%. 40%. The average price of a house in 2007 was £200,000 in the UK. It's now 20%. So it's 160,000, and it's got another 20% at least to fall. And I'm going to show you why it is that in a second that property isn't falling faster. Here we've got the house price slump may last a decade. Once again, it's out there. We're being told. Look at this. Half of all homeowners on the brink, nearly half of homeowners have no cash left for food and utility bills after paying their monthly mortgage bill, according to a survey today. 38,000 people lost their homes in the UK in 2010. Around 53,000 people are expected to lose their homes this year because they cannot keep up repayments. 53,000 people. How many people have been thrown out of their homes in Iceland? I mean, the Iceland economic crash was total, absolutely total and complete. How many people in Iceland have been thrown out of their homes?
None.
Exactly. Absolutely none. Because when the government fell, the new government immediately established a moratorium on anybody being thrown out of their home. And they're applying an incredible level of creativity. They've introduced a program they call debt forgiveness. It's not really a good description. But what they're saying is that if somebody bought a house that was worth £1 million in 2007, and they borrowed 80%, so they borrowed 800,000 crowns, but if that house is only worth, say, 500,000 crowns now, then their mortgage liability should be 80% of the adjusted price, because the higher price was the creation of the banks. Not by the government, not by the people, by the banks. So the people should not have to pay for the manipulation by the banks. And of course, when the Icelandic banks collapsed, because like many local authorities in Britain had been told to put their money into Icelandic banks, and many of them, you know, lost billions of pounds, and they've just had a referendum in Iceland of the people, for the people to decide whether the British and the Netherlanders should be repaid the money that they owe. And you know what the result of that referendum was? Fuck off! We're not going to pay you back. And that's absolutely the right decision, because it is not the responsibility of the Icelandic people to pay this money. It is the responsibility of the banks and the banking community to resolve this issue and not pass the debt onto the people. Fewer than ever are moving home. No surprise there, but let's take a look at why. A decade ago, 600,000 young people a year bought their first home. This has now dropped below 200,000. More than 80% under the age of 30 only managed to buy because they got help from their parents, the bank of mum and dad. Now, this is the reason that property prices are not falling as quickly as they should, because the bankers haven't yet milked the middle classes. Yeah. Right? And let me show you how they're milking the middle classes, because look at this. The average deposit put down by a first-time buyer has rocketed to £28,770. Now, do you remember what the median salary was in this country? 19,200. Well, let me tell you, somebody earning 19,200, or even two people in the same household earning 19,200, ain't going to have 28,000 in the bank to put down as a deposit on a house. Not this year, not next year, not ever. The only way in which they're going to get the deposit is if the parents think they've got equity in the house and they go and remortgage the house to get the money to give to the kids to buy the house. And the bankers are going, yes, because they're getting it twice.
Yeah.
They're creating debt. They're sucking the wealth of the middle classes. They're getting the young generation into the mortgage, into the death grip, making them economic slaves. It's a double whammy. The smartest thing that any parent can do is tell their kids, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry, but you have to wait until you are able to afford to buy your own house. And that way, prices will come down. They'll come down quickly because, you know, if you've got something that you want to sell me and you know I've only got 10 quid in my back pocket. You know I've only got 10 quid in my back pocket. So if you ask for 11, you know there's no possibility of me buying it. So you know that the smart thing to do to make a transaction is to ask me for as much as you know I've got or can get. And if that's 10 quid, then that's what ends up being the transaction. If the banks know that people can access borrowing of any level, then the property prices will be set at that level. Once they know that basically nobody can borrow more than 2.5 times their income, then the prices will fall. So although people think they're doing their kids a favour by lending them money, you are absolutely not. Because you are actually, we are helping our kids to actually get the country deeper and deeper into debt. There's another reason, by the way, let me just go back here. There's another reason that fewer and fewer are moving home, and that's because there's, you know, fewer and fewer demand for people to move into larger properties, because last year, for the first time since records began, the average age at which women in this country had their first child was over the age of 30 for the first time ever. A decade ago, it was 26.2. Now it's over 30. And the reason that women... There's multiple reasons, but one of the reasons that women are obviously not having children because they can't afford to. Absolutely can't afford to. You know, you've got a couple and it takes two wages just to have, you know, a basic lifestyle. And they can't even begin to imagine how they could survive.
Sorry,
we put a book in that window, a nasty feeling, the book had just fallen down on somebody's head. They have no idea how they can survive if one of those incomes goes and they've got an extra mouth to feed. So you can see what's occurring here. And of course, that's with interest rates that are incredibly low. And interest rates, when they're this low, only have one way to go. You know, I know there's some of you in the room, you know, because I can tell you're about the same age as me. And we will remember, you remember when interest rates, I think it was in the early 1980s, interest rates hit 15%.
Yeah.
You know, we'd all borrowed when interest rates were about 8-9%, and it went to 15%, and it was a struggle. And many, many people lost their homes. In the US, you've got tent cities outside all the major cities in the US, where people have had their homes foreclosed, and the only thing they can afford is a tent. In Florida, which has another problem, not only are the prices falling because of the economic crash, but because of obviously what's occurring in the Gulf Coast. So you've got 200,000 people not paying their mortgages in Florida. But you're not reading about that any more than you're reading in Iceland that there's an alternative to austerity measures. And the reason you're not reading about that is because if one person doesn't pay their mortgage, then they're a pariah on society. If 200,000 people stop paying their mortgage, that's a movement.
Yeah.
That's a real movement. And the people of Florida have worked out that there ain't enough bailiffs in the whole of the United States to come down and evict them. So what they're doing is they're working on the basis that even if they get a few months or a few years of rent-free or mortgage-free living, when they are evicted, they'll have saved enough money to be able to go and rent somewhere elsewhere.
Yep.
You know, and that's maybe something that along the lines of what has to happen here. Yep. Here's the magnitude of the debt, way beyond, and this is from a couple of years ago actually, it's way beyond what anybody was told. We were told that the official level of the debt was $903 billion. It was admitted, and I still think this is grossly undercalled, but it was admitted that the debt was $3.8 trillion. What does that mean? Well, this is what it means. For the as yet unborn, this will leave future taxpayers with an additional burden of £200,000 each over their lifetimes to pay for the public services enjoyed by this and previous generations. So a child born in 2011 is born owing £200,000 in future taxes. Now do you start to see why it is that we have to get off our asses and do something? Because it's not our generation that these guys are after. It's the next generations that are coming through. You know, and are we really just going to say, well, sorry guys, you know, hey, we had a great life, we milked it, and you're going to have to pay for it with lives of abject economic slavery on minimum wage? Well, it's going to get worse, because if you think you've got some resources, some liquidity, then the currencies are about to crash. Now, this has been on the cards for a long time. It hasn't happened yet, but each day we get nearer and nearer to the ultimate crash here. I mean, the dollar right now is, I think, at about 1.64 to the pound sterling. But it's going to be tanked. The euro is going to be tanked. I mean, the euro has to be tanked. Look at this in the papers today. The 15 billion scandal as Greeks beg again. We've got the Irish begging for 24 billion. The magnitude of Spain and Italy, as you'll see in a second, is of an order of magnitude that certainly has not been explained to the British public. And I'm going to show you a short clip from Nigel Farage speaking in the European Parliament, and it was a clip that was not broadcast on any British TV station. It was broadcast on Russia Today, and it's on YouTube. You can find it there. Now, when Jim and I were touring Ireland, we came up with the idea that maybe, you know, we could actually start to get some traction by encouraging people to take their money out of the banks.
Yeah.
And this week we came up with this idea. It would be about the second week in November, and the Irish government had announced that they were going to have their budget on December the 7th. Now the Irish always have their budgets in December, and then it kicks in from January 1st. But of course here it was completely outrageous because the government was collapsing. And of course the other thing was that the EU had told them that they had to agree this budget, and they couldn't have an election until they'd agreed the budget. So Jim and I, when we were doing our talks, we were encouraging people to take their money out of the banks either before or certainly no later than December the 7th, the day of the budget. And we said, you better get in there quick, because if everybody does try and take their money out of the bank, of course there won't be enough because of the fractional reserve. There's no money there. So get in there quick. Anyway, literally the next day, we discovered that Eric Cantona was making exactly the same statement and was trying to encourage people in France to take their money out of the banks on December the 7th.
Yeah.
Well, so we latched onto that and said, this is an amazing coincidence, let's try and build it. Well, as you know, there was no crash, and nothing really happened. Or did it? Because if you actually cast your mind back or Google that date, HSBC, Barclays and Lloyds and NatWest all had computer failures and their ATM stopped working. And people who went into the banks to try and withdraw money were told they could only take a maximum of £300. In Ireland, Jim and I were driving through southwest Ireland, and we drove through the town of Killarney. And I said, Jim, let's drive through the high street and let's just see what's going on at the bank, see if there's big lines of people there. Well, there wasn't big lines of people, but outside every bank was Irish Army personnel. So nothing happened, but it just goes to show that the banks thought something might and needed to do whatever it took to stop it happening. So in Ireland, they had the Irish army outside the banks, not in big force, but you know their presence was there. And in the UK, all the major banks basically had computer failures on their ATMs. But if you're going to take your money out of the banks, you've got to do something with it, because there's no point in sticking it under your mattress, because basically it's just going to, well, you might as well stick it, roll it up and stick it in the loo for all the value it's going to have. So what do you do with it? Well, you do with your money what the smart people have been doing with their money for the last decade.
Gold.
Yeah, I mean, this is the point. This is the point 10 years ago at which Gordon Brown was instructed to sell a significant chunk of the UK's gold reserves. He was instructed to sell it to the Rothschilds. And, oh gosh, who was it? I can't remember. Who was it who told him to sell it? Oh, it was the Rothschilds. So how could they have ever known that that was the point at which, if they got Gordon Brown to sell a big chunk of the UK's gold reserves, it was going to create major problems for the UK in the next few years. Interestingly enough, this is also the point at which J.K. Rowling bought a very large chunk of gold. She couldn't quite afford everything that Gordon Brown was offering, but she bought a big chunk. And once again, how could she ever know? But look what's happening here. This is 10 years. 10 years. The growth over 10 years, I'm sorry, has been 440%. 440% in 10 years. Now, when I explain the order of magnitude here, I'm sorry, it's going to make some of you cry. 440% growth over 10 years. Let's take a look at this over 5 years. Over 5 years, you'd have got 156% growth. Now, interestingly, that's what you would have got on silver over the last 12 months. But that silver is a little bit of a bubble because it's based on, and I think I mentioned that JP Morgan have oversold their silver holding. Here's the 1 year movement on gold. 1 year, you'd have got 22.8%. Now that's just a little bit more than the banks are offering, by about 20%. Because the banks don't want people to know how easy it is to access gold, because they want people to put their money into the banks where they can abuse it. And the reason that the gold has been going up in such a phenomenal rate is because the OPEC countries, the oil producing companies, don't want these little pieces of paper called petrodollars, which have got as much worth as if they had Andrex written on them. They don't want petrodollars. So the moment that they deliver the oil, they get the petrodollars, they're selling the petrodollars and buying gold. So although the price of oil is not directly related to the price of gold, it's very closely linked. And right now the price of oil is underpriced, because over the last decade, the price of a barrel of oil has averaged at 7.2% of an ounce of gold. And right now, the barrel is just 6% of an ounce of gold. Now just to put this in perspective, people think that their properties have gone up in value. Okay, at this point here, 10 years ago, you would have needed 363 ounces of gold to buy the average house in this country. 363 ounces. Today, you need 163 ounces of gold to buy the average house in this country. So in other words, a property, the average property in this country today is worth, in real terms, 45% of what it was worth 10 years ago, in real terms. In real terms. You start to see the magnitude of the deception. Yeah? Now, before you all rush out and buy gold, let me tell you that, you know, buying gold is not something you do for a quick gain. You buy gold to protect your existing liquidity, your existing wealth. Because you don't really make money on gold. What you're doing is you're protecting the buying power, the purchasing power of your assets. You know, 60 years ago it was said that one gold coin, a sovereign, would buy a reasonable quality suit. Today, one gold coin, a sovereign, which is about 215, 16 pounds, will buy you a reasonable quality suit. Okay, from Marks and Spencer's, but it's still a reasonable quality suit. It holds the purchasing power. And as you can see with housing, if you'd have bought gold, it effectively has doubled the purchasing power. So if you buy gold, you've got to ride the ups and the downs on a daily basis, because a lot of people make money on a daily basis by buying and selling gold. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, gold went right up to $1,570 an ounce. It closed last Friday under $1,500, and it's back up over $1,500 now. So, you know, if you look at the price of gold on a daily basis and you're holding gold, on one day you're going to be in ecstasy, and the next day you're going to have a coronary. So basically, you don't look at it. But it's the underlying trend that's important. And here, of course, is the underlying trend from 10 years. And even the conservative economists estimate that the price of gold is going to be up around $2,150 by the end of next year. Some of the more aggressive economists believe it could actually achieve that this year. Meanwhile, of course, fiat currencies, fake money based on debt, are going to fall dramatically. Meanwhile, of course, the EU, you know, whilst we're being told that we're in for austerity and everybody's got to take massive cuts except the £200,000 a year chairman of local authorities and the £140,000 a year headmasters and the 1,600 NHS bosses is earning more than the Prime Minister. But for the rest of us, we've got to accept austerity. But of course, if you're in the EU in any way, shape or form, then your budget goes up. Your budget goes up. And the expenses scandal in Westminster is pulled into insignificance when you take a look at what occurs in Brussels. Here's a headline, only from The Sun, of course, "You suck." Talking about, you know, the magnitude of the debt, and all of these numbers are undercalled. I mean, the Greek number here is at least 2.5, maybe even 3 times that. Ireland is much closer to 100% of GDP. And even the UK, you know, 62.1%. The only country in Europe that has any possibility of getting itself out of this mire is Germany. Because Germany has maintained its manufacturing base, whereas the rest of us have shipped it out to the Far East. So we're not creating wealth in any way, shape or form. So the likelihood of getting out of this mire in the existing paradigm is basically slim to none. The world of pain, of course, is the markets crash exactly as scripted by the bankers. But, you know, those who have been managing this meltdown have indeed been extremely well rewarded for what they've done. No more so than Lloyd Blankfein, the epitome of the global socio-psychopath in the financial industry. The guy who has driven this, of course, you know who is the chairman. This is the chief executive officer. The chairman of Goldman Sachs is none other than Bilderberger, Irish Bilderberger, Peter Sutherland, former chairman of BP. And we should be having a bit of fun with Peter Sutherland when we're in Ireland next week. Lloyd Blankfein, meanwhile, this has been his earnings over the last few years. I have no idea how this guy survived in 2008. I mean, he was probably living in a tent. But over the course of the 4 years, while he's driving the global financial meltdown, he earns $148.7 million. This is obscene. It's pornographic. This is absolute obscenity. Here's from the Daily Mail a few weeks ago. Wall Street rewards, he hit an all-time high. And of course, Lloyd Blankfein once again features there. He's tripled his salary and his bonus is up by 40%. And of course, closer to home, we've got the British bankers gloating, absolutely gloating about the fact that, you know, they were all bailed out. Now they're getting the country's economy back on track, which of course they're not. And they're taking these mega rewards. Bob Diamond, you know, £9 million. Eric Daniels of Lloyds, £2 million. Royal Bank of Scotland, which of course was bailed out by the taxpayer. And this guy gets a £2 million bonus, and the taxpayers see nothing. HSBC, £8 million. Why? Why are they getting these amounts of money? Because they bankroll the Tories. And it wouldn't matter if Labour in power, because they bankroll Labour. It doesn't matter who's in power. It's the same suit, different tie, but the same paymaster. That's why, you know, nothing is happening here. It's very, very different in Iceland, as you see in a second. Osborne, of course, the millionaire banker's message to Britain: we're all right, Jack. And Osborne says, yeah, that's about right. We need these people. Without these people, the country has no chance of recovery. Well, I'll tell you what, let's give it a best shot. Let's get rid of these guys and see what we can do, because I think there's no question we couldn't do any worse than these guys. And as I said earlier, you know, the challenge for these guys is to convince the middle classes that they're not going to get nailed. But of course, that's not true. That's not true. The middle classes are starting to feel the pinch, especially those people who are working in the public sector. Not at the top end of the public sector, but in the ranks of middle management. And these people are going to get nailed. And of course, it's going to affect all the services. It's going to affect the care services, the care worker, the nurse, the hospital porter. And, you know, the issues of stress in jobs we're going to see increasing, which the pharmaceutical industry say, yes, thank you very much, because that's more Prozac, which we all benefit from, because Prozac can now be tested for in all the major water supplies of cities in the UK. Prozac and estrogen, such is the prominence of these drugs that it doesn't get absorbed by the body, it's peed out, it goes back into the water supply, and there are levels of Prozac, antidepressants, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, in all the water supplies around the country. It's one of the reasons, by the way, that male fertility is reducing at such a phenomenal rate of knots, because of the amount of chemicals in the water. It is all interlinked. At the other end of the scale, the pensions. In Ireland, the Irish government were told that as part of the bailout conditions, they had to put all of the country's pension pot into play. This is absurd. It's absolutely absurd. These are pensions, of course, that people have been paying into in the UK through supposedly national insurance or whatever for all their working lives, and the likelihood is that they're not necessarily going to see the benefit of that. Unfortunately, I saw this coming in 1997, when Gordon Brown started taxing the growth in pension fund investments, because that had to end in tears, and it surely is. Here's a page from my local paper here. The cuts will hit society's most vulnerable. Well, it's not just, as you saw earlier, it's not just the most vulnerable. In some places in South Devon, it's whole communities, like Oakhampton. You know, and our problem is that thanks to, well, probably the Thatcher years and everything since, and certainly the Blair years, we have lost our ability to take social responsibility. You know, we have unfortunately got ourselves into an I'm all right, Jack consciousness. And providing we're okay, then it doesn't matter what's going on elsewhere. But, you know, it may not be too far away where we actually need to be part of a much wider community. Let me show you a short clip from a sketch. Now, the sketch is based in the Roman Senate, but this script of this short sketch is what has basically transpired in all Western parliaments over the last few years or so.
All fellow members of the Roman Senate, hear me. Shall we continue to build palace after palace for the rich, or shall we aspire to a more noble purpose and build decent housing for the poor? How does the Senate vote?
Fuck the poor!
You know, the fledgling Italian government in the 1880s, when the Papal States effectively merged into the country that we know today as Italy, and the new government had no experience of raising state finances. And so they commissioned an economist by the name of Lorenzo to give them some counsel as to how they could raise state finance for their new projects. I don't know how much he charged them or how much they paid him, but his report consisted of three words: tax the poor. Tax the poor. Because you can tax the poor until the pips squeak. You just leave them the crumbs, because they will just have to focus on keeping the roof over their head and the food on the table. If you tax the middle classes, they will either leave the country, as they are in Ireland, or they will employ somebody who can help them find ways to avoid paying the taxes. And when I went back to Ireland in December of last year, I had to do a double take at Dublin Airport, because this is a sculpture on the roof of Dublin Airport, and it just epitomised for me the sort of state of the people in Ireland. It's like, yeah, please, please, we can't take any more. Please stop, stop, stop. Unfortunately, in Ireland, it's going to get a lot worse until such time as the people realise what's occurring here and take some hopefully positive action. But as Nigel Farage expresses, unfortunately, what's occurring may be forcing the Irish people into a proverbial corner. So let's take a look at what Farage has to say here.
Mr. Co-President Nigel Farage, Freedom and Democracy.
Well, good morning, Mr. Van Rompuy. You've been in office for 1 year, and in that time, the whole edifice is beginning to crumble. There's chaos. The money's running out. I should thank you. You should perhaps be the pin-up boy of the Eurosceptic movement. But just look around this chamber this morning. Just look at these faces. Look at the fear. Look at the anger. Paul Barroso here looks like he's seen a ghost. You know, they're beginning to understand that the game is up. And yet, in their desperation to preserve their dream, they want to remove any remaining traces of democracy from the system. And it's pretty clear that none of you have learned anything. You know, when you yourself, Mr. Van Rompuy, say that the euro has brought us stability, I suppose I could applaud you for having a sense of humour, but isn't this really just the bunker mentality? You know, your fanaticism is out in the open. You talked about the fact that it was a lie to believe that the nation state could exist in a 21st century globalised world. Well, that may be true in the case of Belgium, who haven't had a government for 6 months, but for the rest of us, right across every member state in this union, and perhaps this is why we see the fear in the faces, increasingly people are saying, we don't want that flag, we don't want the anthem, we don't want this political class, we want the whole thing consigned to the dustbin of history. And we had the Greek tragedy earlier on this year, and now we have the situation in Ireland. Now I know that the stupidity and greed of Irish politicians has a lot to do with this. They should never, ever have joined the euro. They suffered with low interest rates, a false boom, and a massive bust. But look at your response to them. What they're being told, as their government's collapsing, is that it would be inappropriate for them to have a general election. In fact, Commissioner Wren here said they had to agree their budget first before they'd be allowed to have a general election. Just who the hell do you think you people are? You are very, very dangerous people indeed. Your obsession with creating this euro state means that you're happy to destroy democracy. You appear to be happy for millions and millions of people to be unemployed and to be poor. Untold millions must suffer so that your euro dream can continue. Well, it won't work, because it's Portugal next. With their debt levels of 325% of GDP, they're the next ones on the list. And after that, I suspect it'll be Spain. And the bailout for Spain would be 7 times the size of Ireland. And at that moment, all of the bailout money has gone. There won't be any more. But it's even more serious than economics. Because if you rob people of their identity, if you rob them of their democracy, then all they are left with is nationalism and violence. I can only hope and pray that the euro project is destroyed by the markets before that really happens.
The next speaker.
You know, ever since Farage had his near-death experience, he doesn't give a damn, which is fantastic, which is absolutely the way it needs to be. But unfortunately, his rhetoric is not being broadcast. Unfortunately, it's a closed shop. So unless you know what you're looking for, unless you actually go seek it out, the vast majority of people aren't seeing this. But of course, he's absolutely right. What's going on in Ireland is potentially going to force the Irish people into a corner. And then they just better damn well hope that 40 years of fluoridation of the water has worked. You know, because right now you've got some of the, you know, the Irish heroes of the early part of the 20th century, like Michael Collins, and Irish visionaries of the latter part of the 20th century, like Raymond Crotty, absolutely turning in their graves at what's going on right now. And here it is, rubbed in the noses of the Irish people. This is the headline from the Irish Daily Mail. The man, and this appeared literally on the day that Farage was making that speech, the man who's now running Ireland, Ollie Wren, the EU commissioner, unelected, but this is the guy who is effectively holding the purse strings of Ireland, and consequently, of course, he's effectively controlling the country. A few days later was an even more outrageous headline in the Irish Daily Mail, and the headline was, "We are no longer a sovereign nation." In fact, that sentiment actually applies to all of the signatories of the EU treaty, but of course it was being absolutely rammed home in Ireland, and the Irish people just ignored. Well, a few people protested at the GPO, the scene of the famous uprising in 1916, but other than that, nothing. But something is stirring in Ireland. Something is stirring. And there's an Irishman, unfortunately he doesn't live in Ireland, unfortunately he works in the financial sector in North America, and he was interviewed last November, and this short clip from his interview went viral in Ireland, and there's a campaign to get this guy, you're going to see here, to stand for President of Ireland.
Financial News, and today we're talking to a real Irishman and someone in the money business about what's going on in Ireland with the Celtic Tiger and the banks are hurting so much, the downfall. What's the story here?
Do you really want to know?
I'd love to know.
But I tell you, it's like what has happened all over the Western world for the last 20 or 30 years. Greed, and more fucking greed, and cheap money. Ireland is a tragedy with the Tiger. We have... I'd say four causes. We had a stupid fucking government. The regulator was asleep at the wheel. We had very deceitful, conniving, and corrupt developers. And of course, above all, wanking fucking banker. The last 20, 30 years are getting these massive bonuses, these employees and directors of banks, on the misfortune of the working class, and getting these huge bonuses and salaries. But you know, if you and all these arseholes should be thrown in jail and the keys thrown away for the rest of their life. You know, sir, if you went in and you're unemployed and you wanted to take a loaf of bread out of it, a store or a supermarket to feed your family, guess what? You'll be up in court for it. These assholes are living all over the world now on the backs of the misfortunate and working people. And who's going to pay for all this? We've mortgaged the next generation or two. Who's going to pay for it? The working man. We got the labourer, the small farmer, the fisherman, the nurse, the teacher, the policeman, the fireman, the plumber, the carpenter. Fuck's sake, man, this is a joke.
So I'm sensing a wee bit of discontent.
By the way, let's not be too cocky in this part of North America either. All these debts that people have accumulated over the last 30 years, hey, everybody gets their day in the sunshine.
And you know, speaking of the Celtic Tiger and all that you mentioned, you know that Michael Flatley is really from Chicago, but that's another story.
Fuck off!
Don't you hate it when people hold back and won't tell you what they really think? This is the sentiment. I mean, this is the sentiment that you will hear more and more amongst the senior citizens within Ireland. Unfortunately, many of the young people in Ireland have been brainwashed. They've been brainwashed into thinking that the only way forward is to be part of the EU. The toughest ride that Jim and I got when we were giving the presentations in Ireland was at Limerick University, where the political science class there had been instructed to come along to our presentation. And of course, these guys tried to demonstrate that they knew more about deep geopolitics than we did. But they didn't bank on a mature student. And this guy was in his mid-late 60s. And he'd been very quiet through the whole evening. And eventually, at the end of the evening, he stood up and he said, "Jim, Ian," he said, "do you mind if I take the floor for a second?" And we said, "No, sure, carry on." And he turned and he ripped in to these students, absolutely ripped into them, and he said, "You know, your grandfathers and their fathers would be mortified to hear you speaking like this. They gave their lives so that the Irish nation could exist. And now you and many of your fellow countrymen have given the country away without a shot being fired." And I mean, you know, well, it was powerful stuff. So we know something is stirring, and Farage was absolutely spot on. Yes. And unfortunately, of course, what these people want is the mass uprising, because they want to be able to enforce the austerity measures. But it's here, you know, it's getting worse. The Eurozone's bottomless pit of debt. We need to do something about it. And basically, we need to do what the Icelanders have done, which is start arresting the perpetrators, arresting the bankers. They've arrested their former prime minister for malfeasance, for the financial mismanagement of the country. They told the IMF to go take a hike, and that they are not going to take on board the debt. We need to be doing the same in the UK. We need to take control of the Bank of England. The Bank of England is a private bank. The mythology that the Bank of England is a nationalised bank is as much as a myth as the Federal Reserve being a US government bank. Yeah. There's nothing, the Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express. And it certainly doesn't have a reserve either. It has a spreadsheet. Now we need to establish our own bank where the country issues the currency on behalf of its citizens, and that any interest paid comes back to the people, and that interest is then used for infrastructure projects, and it doesn't go into the pockets of the private bankers. This isn't pie in the sky. This is exactly what's happening in Ireland right now. It's exactly what happens in Russia. It's what happens in Venezuela, in Cuba, what was happening in Libya, what was happening in Iraq, what is still happening in Iran and North Korea. So it's not pie in the sky. It's happening. We just have to take the initiative en masse and take it back under control. It ain't going to happen overnight. And of course, these guys have their controlled opposition in place. All of these committees looking at monetary reform, these are all distractions. There's only one solution, and that is to take total control. Yeah. We know it works. There's one state in the US, one state that is not bankrupt. North Dakota. And the reason North Dakota is not bankrupt was because in 1918 they had a governor who was a visionary, and he could see exactly what would happen to the state of North Dakota if he allowed the state to be embraced by the Federal Reserve. So in 1922 North Dakota issued its own legislation stating that it would not participate in the Federal Reserve. It established the Central Bank of North Dakota. North Dakota issues its own currency. All of the state departments in North Dakota are required to bank with the North Dakota Bank. Any interest paid comes back to the people. We know it works. The banksters know it works, and that's why they're not sharing any of this information, and they do everything they possibly can to keep it out of the mainstream media. Mayor Amstel Rothschild said, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes its laws." Yeah. All the way along, these guys are telling us what's going on. Yep. You know, nobody in the political system can argue they weren't warned about the possible extent of the problems facing the country. Well, they might have got away with it one time, but they can't get away with it again. And you know, what's their excuse going to be when the whammy really hits? There are three tools that these guys have that they absolutely rely on people using, or not using as the case might be. These are the same tools as the complementary alternative health practitioners applied, and how they effectively managed to give away their livelihoods and their industry. And that is apathy. The apathy of the people. Keep them amused with the circuses. But the most powerful one, as I've said, is abdication. Now, you know, one of the things that has occurred tonight by you coming here is, unfortunately, you can no longer say that you don't know what's going on, that I haven't sown a few seeds with you. So if you go away and do nothing, then you are falling very much into this camp, abdication, because it means that you have specifically elected to ignore anything that I've said tonight, or fail to do any further research and just let it all wash over you. Yeah. And the last one is willful ignorance. And they don't care. These guys don't care which one of these you fall into, as long as you fall into one of them, because it means you're no threat. What they're concerned about is the people who start to understand what's occurring, don't form organisations, because they love organisations, because they can infiltrate them and break them down. This is not about forming organisations, it's about loose-knit communities of interest. Yeah. Ostensibly it's about individuals, then forming small groups, but that's it. And then the small groups may be coming together, you know, for events such as this or whatever. And then, you know, people going away and effectively doing whatever it is they feel they can do or want to do or can do. But not forming any organisation. Yeah. Because that would be decapitated and infiltrated in a heartbeat. Right. What we see coming, of course, we're already seeing it. Unfortunately, I was predicting this, you know, a number of years ago. Eventually, when people realise how they have been shackled by debt, with of course the students are realising it, because they're shackled with debt and no possibility of paying it off. But as other people realise, you know, the magnitude of the problem, they're going to hit the streets. And this is the time when maybe we have to hunker down, because this isn't for us to be doing. We don't need to be hitting the streets. That's what they want, because that enables them to put in even more draconian measures. That's why maybe we need to have that food reserve, that water reserve, because we don't need to be participating in this. Unless it morphs into another type of protest. And let me introduce you to protest South Korea style, because this is a protest from South Korea in 2007, April 2007. That's what it looked like on the first day. That's what it looked like at night. On the second day, at night. On the third day, and so on for 7 days. Do you know what they were protesting against? They were protesting against the fact that the World Trade Organization was demanding that South Korea import growth hormone contaminated beef. South Korea is a nation of farmers. They know what the impact of bringing growth hormone contaminated beef into their food chain would be. In the EU, up until very recently, we all believed that we were not importing growth hormone contaminated beef. And so much so that the EU pays the World Trade Organization a fine of 150 million euros a year because we refused to import growth hormone contaminated beef. But in the last few days, it's been revealed that growth hormone contaminated beef has been coming in to the UK food chain through the back door. And now, of course, once that starts, then, you know, it's much more difficult to stop. But in South Korea, they did manage to get it shut down, because basically the South Korean government said to the World Trade Organization, well, you know, shit, you're destroying our economy. And so they agreed a nominal fine. But, of course, you know, they won't stop until they do achieve it. This is from Time magazine a couple of years ago, and this back then it was looking at Ireland and Portugal in particular. But now it's right across Europe. We have a phenomenal unemployment problem with under 25s. You know, when I came into the world of employment from college, there was no possibility of being unemployed, unless you really wanted to, because there was full employment. And basically, employers were, you know, crawling over each other to try and get you to join them. I think the official unemployment figure when I started looking for work was 250,000 people. That's outrageous. Now, of course, we've got a generation of youngsters that are qualified in some cases, you know, things like finance and, you know, business management from major universities like Cambridge, Oxford, other red brick universities, but they've got no possibility of finding work. So what do? They work in Pizza Hut or TGI Fridays because they have to earn less than 14,800 or whatever it is, because as soon as they start earning more than that, they have to start paying back the student loan. So it's not worth them finding a job that pays between 14,800 and 27,000. So they either have to earn less so they don't pay back the student loan, or more so they can actually afford to pay back the student loan. Or go to Tofu in Mozambique and just become a diving instructor where you can live on £300 a month. Woodrow Wilson again, he said some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere so organised, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, they'd better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it. You know, back then, the people, the masses, didn't have any kind of means of communication apart from their immediate community. That's different today. And there's a fuck sight more of us than there is of them.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's about time we started actually utilising that. It doesn't have to be violent. In fact, it must not be violent. We must not give them any reason to introduce any more draconian measures. We have to adopt things like the South Korean mode of protest. Not these waste of time protests in London where people go up on a Saturday morning and they leave on a Saturday evening because no one gives a damn.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah, everybody feels good about it. The transport companies do very well out of it. The police get the overtime and the riot training. The food vendors do very well out of it. But nothing happens. And that's it. You know, I mean, the Clegg said, well, you know, hey, yeah, people hit the streets, but we ain't going to do anything about it. So we've got to start getting creative. We're going to start, you know, using a bit of noddle rather than falling into the controlled opposition traps. Here's another great book. This is a book by my good friend William Engdahl. He's a former economist. By the way, he's been wheelchair bound for most of his life. And a couple of years ago, he came to the realization that the reason he's been wheelchair bound for pretty much all of his life was due to the polio vaccine. So his next book is an expose of the vaccine industry. But he's written some superb books over the last few years. He wrote an outstanding book, in my opinion, one of the best books on the GM food industry called Seeds of Destruction. And this is the book that he released last year, Gods and Money. It's an absolutely superb read. I'm going to just share this quote with you. It's from a document. I'm going to tell you what the document is in a second. And I'm going to encourage you to go away and Google this document and read it. It's not a long document. This document appeared on a financial website on June 21st, interestingly enough, on 2002. And this quote is from it. It says, "We will focus their attention towards money and material goods so they may never connect with their inner self." The document is called The Secret Covenant. And it's an incredibly prescient document. Of course, people say, oh, it's just a forgery, whatever that means. But bear in mind that it appeared nearly 9 years ago, and then read it through, and then reflect on the world today. And reflect on the world as it was in 2002, and what you see is that basically this is, once again, a script. It's a template. But the reason I flag it up is because 40 years ago, Zbigniew Brzezinski, that guy again, right, the protege of Bernard Baruch, the mentor of, supposedly, of Barry Satoru, I mean, Baruch Barack Obama, he wrote a book in 1969, published in 1970, called Between Two Ages, The Technotronic Era. And once again, this is an incredibly prescient book. It's effective. I mean, everything that Brzezinski was writing about in 1969 has come to pass. How could he have known? But one of the comments he made in that book, which is why I flagged this, 40 years ago, he said, "The biggest challenge for Western governments will be to keep their people locked into consumerist materialism, preventing them from realizing who they truly are." So here's Brzezinski 40 years ago alluding to the fact that there's some kind of spiritual awakening occurring and people are starting to get in touch with their deeper, higher self, whatever, and Western governments have got to try and shut it down by keeping them locked into consumerist materialism. This is the same guy who last year, almost exactly 1 year ago, on May the 15th, in a presentation to the Council on Foreign Relations, said the biggest obstacle to establishing the one world government is the rapid political awakening of the masses.
Absolutely.
So we've got the same guy, 40 years apart, talking about the need to shut down the spiritual awakening and the need to shut down the political awakening. Well, many of you may know that, say, in addition to my research in deep geopolitics, I've also spent many years studying the wisdom of the indigenous peoples and the knowledge of the indigenous peoples and the relevance of that to everything that's occurring right now. And interestingly for me, in the 6 months prior to 9/11, I was in Central America studying Mayan mythology and Mayan cosmology. And then last year, I spent some time in Peru with these people, the Quero. And the reason I spent the time with the Quero was because this is a group of people that had been lost to humanity for 500 years. They were chased into the high Andes by the conquistadors in the early part of the 16th century. And everybody assumed that they'd been murdered because the conquistadors came back, these guys didn't. These guys came out of the high Andes in the early 1960s. And the reason they came out of the mountains was because they had, they said, a knowledge and a wisdom that had been passed down to them for 25 generations whilst they were in the mountains, and they now needed to share it with the rest of humanity. Now, thanks to some wonderful anthropologists, not least a guy called Alberto Villaldo, you know, we have access to a lot of the information that these guys have been sharing. But I wanted to go and hear it from the proverbial horse's mouth, as it were. And I could spend a whole evening talking about my time with these guys. But there's a couple of very, very significant pieces that they shared. Because they said, look, you know, the world is changing. We're at a very, very important juncture in the evolutionary process of humanity, and I think many of us sense that. Because we cannot continue down this paradigm in any way, shape or form. And if we do, we're effectively participating in the destruction of humanity and the creation of a slave race.
Yep.
And that's the bottom line. And that's the decision we have to take. Are we human or are we nothing more than slaves? And it's very, very significant. Well, these guys are saying that something's about to occur very, very soon, which is going to trigger in a massive way to take a quantum leap forward, this awakening that Brzezinski was alluding to 40 years ago. And what they're saying is that this event, which is due to actually kick in October of this year, will actually awaken what we have been told is junk DNA. And in awakening this junk DNA, it will completely transform the way in which we relate to our environment. Because when you think the frequencies with which we interact with our environment are extremely narrow. Our visual frequencies, our aural frequencies, our sensual frequencies are extremely narrow. And we know that dogs and cats are able to perceive elements outside of our frequency bandwidth. And we have no idea of what perception other races or species that share the planet really have. And what these guys are saying is that this event is literally going to open up whole new horizons to us. And some people will literally die because they just will not be able to deal with this quantum change in perception. So what is that event? Well, that event is this, the solar storms. And interestingly for me, it's not just the Quero who talk about this. There are many other indigenous peoples from around the world. And in fact, I only discovered literally a few weeks ago that Andrew Collins, a guy called Andrew Collins, had written a book called The Cygnus Mysteries, actually discussing exactly this phenomena from the indigenous peoples that that he'd been working with. The solar storms. NASA and many other people within the scientific control grid will tell you that the solar storms are going to be terrible because they're going to wipe out our networks. They're going to wipe out our communication networks, you know, wipe out our power networks, maybe even prevent the internal combustion engine from working. Well, the Quero, when I sort of said, well, so what's your reaction to that? They just laughed. And they knew one word in English. One of them was a young girl, about 38, but she was the translator for me. But the other guys, obviously, they just spoke Quero, but they knew one word in English, and that word was idiot. And they seemed to use it quite a lot. And their point was that, you know, we're not going to need these things.
Exactly.
Because our perception, the way in which we relate to everything, is going to be changed so far beyond anything that we can comprehend today. We're just not going to need these accoutrements of this dimension. And I said, but so will everybody have this opportunity to make this quantum leap? And once again, they started laughing, and I heard the word idiot again. And they said, well, yes, everybody will have the opportunity, but some people will deliberately reject it because they have too much commitment, too much existential attachment to these accoutrements, like their phone, their computer, you know, their car. And so they will actually prevent themselves from taking advantage of this great opportunity. And so what they're basically saying is, this may be a division of humanity, not just two divisions. And what they said is, consider the possibility that actually the 6 or whatever billion people it is on this planet all move into a new realm that is appropriate to their level of development. Which, of course, interestingly, is another take on certain other philosophies. So the bottom line is, we don't know. They don't really know. But it's very interesting for me that there are so many, many indigenous peoples from around the world. And another great book to read is Jeff Stray's book, Beyond 2012, Catastrophe or Ecstasy. Because Jeff is a superb researcher. He doesn't cast any aspersion or any particular attachment to any particular belief. What he's done is he's trawled the indigenous peoples, and he's trawled all of the information that's out there in the public domain and pulled it all together. And it is incredible how much similarity there is to all of these ancient philosophies, these ancient visions about this particular time in our history. So, the one thing that the two things that the Quero say we have to do. One is that we have to actively participate in trying to physically bring about the sort of changes that we want to see. We can't sit back and just say, well, the storms are coming, we'll just wait and see what that brings. We have to get in amongst it and actually physically contribute to being the change we want to see. What they say is that actually in of itself, that's not enough. In fact, to do that alone, it's just completely impotent. The other side of it is that we have to find the time and create the space to visualize. They use the word dream. We have to visualize the type of future that we want to see. And we have to do the two together. And when we have to visualize without having an existential commitment to a particular future, because that might be limiting us based on what's about to occur, perhaps. Now, all of this may be a complete load of tosh. Maybe, or maybe not. And I leave it to you to decide, you know, how much of that you wish to embrace. For me, the reality is that on the physical realm, this existing paradigm is totally unsustainable, and I, for one, am definitely not prepared to pass this as a legacy to my kids or to my grandkids or to the other future generations.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, thank you. So, whatever your philosophy, and we should not get bogged down in the details of differences of individual philosophy. The only thing that we should be concerned about is our philosophy benign and benevolent towards humanity or not? All the rest is mere detail. Because the agenda being pursued by those who are driving the pernicious agenda would appear not to be benign or benevolent towards humanity. Or is it? Because consider the outrageous hypothesis that what I'm talking about and what these guys are perpetrating as their aggressive agenda are two means to the same end. Because, you know, in life, we learn most when we're in the shit. We learn most when we're going through deep personal trauma, when we find ourselves embroiled in deep drama. When life's just trucking along, it's all tickety-boo, we're existing, we're not living. It's only when, you know, things are going wrong, generally, you know, whether it's health issues, financial issues, relationship issues, whatever. But it's only when things are going seriously wrong that we actually are forced to reflect on the way in which we are interacting with everything around us. We are forced to effectively go through a process of re-evaluation, a process of metanoia. Re-evaluating everything we think we know and looking at maybe what our own behaviour, our own thoughts, our own words, our own deeds have contributed to bringing about that drama. So consider the possibility that the drama, the trauma that is being created by those who are perpetrating this agenda that we've been talking about tonight. Now, I'm not suggesting for one moment they know this, but consider the possibility that they are actually contributing to helping humanity to wake the fuck up. And our challenge is also the same. You know, to try and encourage people to actually take a look at what's occurring and then decide whether they want to be human or slaves. You know, some of you will be familiar with the 11/11 phenomena, yes? This is a phenomenon that's been around for 20 years now. And it's a trigger. It's an awakening trigger. If you haven't seen it before, go Google 11:11. And you look at this, how this phenomena has, in many cases, been the trigger point for getting a lot of people to question their reality. So you've been a wonderful, wonderful audience. And, you know, I really, really appreciate you coming out tonight and enduring the floor or wherever it is that you sat down. And I'm just going to finish with this quote. This quote that I'm going to take from Marcus Aurelius, and as somebody did point out to me recently, it was also used by Maximus in Gladiator, and they tried to tell me that the quote was first used in Maximus, but no, it wasn't. The quote was used by Marcus Aurelius, a Roman Empire of, I think it was the 2nd century or 3rd century AD. And he was a wonderful philosopher. He was also a Roman emperor and, of course, a warrior. But he was a wonderful philosopher. And he made this observation. He said, "What we do in life ripples through eternity." And I believe that that quote, that observation, is even more important and more pertinent today than it was when he uttered it nearly 2 millennia ago.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.